In 2008, South Los Angeles enacted this really sweeping zoning policy.
Oh, right, the fast food ban.
Exactly. They basically banned the opening of any new standalone fast food restaurants. And I mean, the logic seemed completely airtight at the time.
Sure, yeah, just remove the source of the problem.
Right. The area was facing a severe obesity crisis, so city planners decided, well, if you build fewer drive crusts, people will naturally eat fewer burgers, and public health will improve.
That makes total sense on paper.
It does. But the data following that ban revealed something completely counterintuitive. Fast food consumption and obesity in the area actually went up.
Yeah, it's the ultimate cautionary tale in public health.
It really is.
We have this deeply ingrained assumption in our culture
Yeah.
that eating healthy is just a straightforward binary choice. You look at a plate, you see an apple or a donut, and you just make a decision.
Just sheer willpower, right?
Exactly. But that assumption completely ignores the invisible scaffolding surrounding that choice. When we judge individual diets, we very rarely look at the complex economic or physical and psychological environments that dictate what even ends up on the plate in the first place.
Which is exactly why today we are looking at why our intuition about healthy eating is almost entirely wrong. We are so thrilled you're joining us for this deep dive because we have curated a really fascinating stack of sources just for you to help map out that invisible
It
scaffolding.
is a great stack today.
It is. On the table today, we have a clinical nutrition workshop report from the NIH and the USDA. We've got a massive longitudinal CDC study tracking nearly 14,000 Canadian adolescents.
Yep, a really eye-opening study.
Definitely. We also have a grant proposal for a grassroots initiative called Neighbors Feeding Neighbors. And finally, a qualitative JAMA study examining the hidden impacts of Meals on Wheels.
It's a really diverse collection of data. We're ranging from top-level federal policy all the way down to hyper-local volunteerism. But every single document here points to the exact same underlying reality. Food is never just about calories.
It never is. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore those invisible forces shaping our physical and mental health. We want to move completely past that outdated idea of sheer willpower and investigate how our built environments, our local communities, and federal programs actually govern our well-being.
Right, because willpower alone doesn't put a grocery store in your neighborhood.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the physical landscape of food access in America. The NIH and USDA report highlights that 13.5 million Americans currently have limited access to supermarkets.
Wow, millions.
Yeah, 13.5 million living in areas that are widely categorized as food deserts.
But the Clinical Nutrition Workshop report actually challenges the very framing of that statistic.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, before we can even discuss solutions, they argue we have to distinguish between food security and nutrition security.
Okay, what's the difference there?
So, food security simply implies a person has access to enough calories to survive the day,
Yeah.
without experiencing acute hunger. Just basic survival.
Right, just getting something in your stomach.
Exactly. But nutrition security is a much higher, much more critical bar. It requires equitable, consistent access to affordable foods that actively prevent chronic disease over a lifespan.
Oh, wow. So not just calories, but disease-preventing calories.
Precisely. And the researchers also point out that to understand why nutrition security is so incredibly elusive, we have to split the physical environment into two distinct concepts.
Okay, I'm following.
You have the community nutrition environment, and then you have the consumer food environment.
Right, I remember reading this. The community environment is purely geographic, right? It's literally just the map of where stores are physically located within a neighborhood.
Yep, just dots on a map.
But the consumer environment is everything that happens the second you walk through those sliding automatic doors. It's the shelf space, the targeted marketing, the quality of the produce, and crucially, the price tags.
And what's fascinating here is why well-intentioned, top-down physical interventions fail so spectacularly when they confuse those two environments.
Like the South LA ban.
Exactly like that. The logical government fix for a food desert has historically been, well, just change the geography. The NIH report analyzed these major initiatives, like the Healthy Food Financing Initiative.
Right, the HFFI.
Yeah, they poured millions and millions of dollars into opening these beautiful, full-service supermarkets in underserved areas of Pittsburgh and Chicago.
Just dropping a grocery store right into the middle of the desert.
Right. But the data on those massive initiatives is incredibly sobering. Having a brand new grocery store down the street certainly improved the residents' perceptions of their neighborhood. I mean, people like having the infrastructure.
Sure. It looks nice. It feels like an investment.
Exactly. But it didn't actually increase their fruit and vegetable consumption. And it didn't move the needle on their body mass index at all.
Which perfectly explains the paradox of the South LA fast food ban. The zoning laws targeted standalone buildings, but they left these massive loopholes for strip malls and food courts.
Right. The demand didn't change.
Exactly. Existing fast food chains just cranked up their marketing. Non-standalone junk food flooded the zone to meet that unchanged demand, and residents just, you know, drove a few blocks further to get it.
Because altering the physical proximity of a building does not alter the structural determinants of health. We are talking about entrenched systemic barriers here. Poverty, structural racism, inequitable housing, and frankly, time poverty.
Time poverty is such a huge factor.
It really is. You can parachute a gleaming supermarket into a neighborhood, but if a resident is working three jobs just to cover exorbitant rent, they do not have the time to prep and cook raw vegetables.
Right, and they probably lack the disposable income to risk buying fresh produce that might spoil before they even have a chance to eat it. Cheap, highly processed food is fundamentally a low-risk, high-calorie economic calculation.
Yeah, I look at this the exact same way I look at buying a gym membership.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Right.
Right.
Because if the city builds a state-of-the-art gym directly across the street from my house, my fitness desert is technically fixed. The geographic barrier is totally gone.
The building is right there.
But if the membership costs $100 a month, and I am physically exhausted from working double shifts, the mere existence of that building doesn't change my underlying financial or physiological reality. I don't get healthier just by living near barbells.
That is a perfect analogy, and the experts at the NIH workshop reached that exact same conclusion. Brick-and-mortar zoning laws are entirely insufficient on their own.
So what actually works? Well, the report suggests that broader economic policies, specifically interventions like a universal basic income or significant minimum wage increases, might actually be the most effective nutritional interventions we have.
Wow. Treating wages as a nutrition intervention?
Yeah. Increasing a family's baseline income fundamentally alters their consumer environment. It gives them the actual economic power to absorb the risk of buying healthy food.
Okay, but if top-down zoning doesn't work, and we are waiting on sweeping economic policies that could take decades to materialize, we have to look at what happens to the people currently living in these nutrient-poor environments right now.
Right, the people trapped in the meantime.
Exactly. And this is where the CDC's COMPASS study comes in. It shifts our focus from the physical environment to the adolescent bodies trapped inside it. They followed 13,887 Canadian teenagers.
That is a massive data set.
It is. And the baseline mental health statistics alone are just, they are a public health crisis. Over 30% of these kids exhibited clinically significant depressive symptoms, and 22.7% had significant anxiety symptoms.
And the gender breakdown was pretty stark too, right?
Yeah. The rates for female students were almost double those of their male peers.
Just heartbreaking. And when the researchers mapped the dietary habits of those 14,000 adolescents onto their mental health outcomes, the findings were incredibly stark.
What did they find?
High consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. So your sodas, energy drinks, those highly sweetened coffees that was prospectively associated with greater severity of depressive and anxiety symptoms, along with just poorer overall psychological well-being.
And on the flip side?
Conversely, consistent consumption of vegetables and fruit was linked to measurably better psychological resilience.
Okay, I do want to push back on the causality here just a bit. Because teenage years are inherently stressful, are we absolutely sure these drinks are causing the mental health issues?
That's a very fair question to ask.
Right, because isn't it highly likely that a teenager suffering from severe anxiety or depression is just simply self-medicating? Like they are grabbing a massive energy drink just to get the dopamine hit required to survive third period math.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the methodology of the COMPASS study actually isolates that exact variable.
Oh, really? How did they do that?
The researchers designed this as a longitudinal study, meaning they didn't just take a single snapshot in time and claim a correlation. They tracked these students over an entire year. And crucially, they adjusted the data for the adolescent's baseline mental health.
Wait, so they accounted for the depression the teenagers already had on day one of the study?
They did. Even after adjusting for existing psychological distress, the data demonstrated that high sugar intake reliably preceded the subsequent worsening of their symptoms over the next 12 months.
Wow. So the diet was driving the decline.
Exactly. Diet was a leading indicator of mental health decline, not merely a symptom of it. And the biological mechanism behind this is vital to understand.
Let's get into that, because it sounds intense.
It is. When an adolescent consumes massive amounts of liquid sugar, it triggers aggressive spikes in blood glucose. And that is immediately followed by severe crashes.
Right, the classic sugar crash.
But those metabolic crashes actually provoke a neuroendocrine stress response. The body releases cortisol and adrenaline to compensate. And that physically mimics and exacerbates the somatic symptoms of panic and anxiety.
That makes so much sense. Your body literally thinks it's in a panic state.
Exactly. Furthermore, highly processed diets drive chronic neuroinflammation, and they disrupt the gut microbiome, which, you know, is responsible for synthesizing a massive portion of the body's serotonin.
So they are actively disrupting their own neurochemistry. And the scale of that metabolic disruption is terrifying when you look at the consumption data in the study.
It really is.
The researchers note that 17.5% of all free sugar consumed in Canada comes purely from sugar-sweetened beverages. We are not talking about an occasional treat here. We are talking about a foundational pillar of their daily caloric intake, actively altering their psychological trajectory.
And this brings us right back to the core theme of the NIH report. The CDC researchers are urgently calling for population-level policies, implement sugar taxes, mandate clear product labeling, and subsidize fresh foods.
Treating it like a systemic issue.
Exactly. The overarching mandate is to stop lecturing teenagers about personal responsibility when they're navigating an environment built to aggressively market products that disrupt their developing neurochemistry.
But, you know, sweeping systemic changes like national sugar taxes, overhauling agricultural subsidies, implementing universal basic income, these are titanic legislative battles.
They take years.
Yeah.
Decades, even.
Right. And meanwhile, families are experiencing acute food insecurity in their neighborhoods tonight. Grassroots networks are being forced to step into the massive void left by failing federal policies, which leads us directly to the grant proposal for Neighbors Feeding Neighbors.
Yeah, the Neighbors Feeding Neighbors program in Wright County, Minnesota. It is a masterclass in pragmatic, immediate public health action.
The co-founders, Susie and Kirk, they designed this brilliantly simple model. They assemble free grab-and-go meal kits, and these contain shelf-stable ingredients and a recipe card tailored to feed a family of four.
And they started so small, right?
So small. They started by leaving just 12 of these kits at the end of their yard. But that hyper-local experiment has since expanded. They've distributed over 720 kits, which equates to roughly 2,800 meals.
That's incredible growth for a neighborhood project.
It is. But the brilliance of NFN isn't just the food itself, it is the distribution architecture. They completely bypass the centralized warehouse model. Instead, they place these kits in existing community hubs. You know, the local library, coffee shops, churches.
And the most critical element of their model is that it is entirely barrier-free. There is no income verification. There is no proof of residency required.
Zero gatekeeping.
None. Nobody has to fill out a form or speak to a caseworker. If a person needs a meal kit, they simply take one.
Right, because traditional food banks do heroic work, but their infrastructure inherently involves immense friction.
So much red tape.
Yeah. Imagine you are incredibly thirsty, and there is a glass of tap water right in front of you. But to drink it, you have to fill out a 15-page financial disclosure form, prove your address, and sit through an interview explaining why you couldn't afford your own water.
It's exhausting just thinking about it.
It's like applying for a mortgage just to get a basic human need met. That bureaucracy creates an artificial drought of shame. I like to compare the NFN model to a bowl of free mints at a restaurant host stand.
Oh, I like that.
Right. By treating these meal kits like that, just sitting on a shelf for anyone to quietly grab, they strip the friction and the humiliation entirely out of the equation.
And the physiological relief of removing that shame is profound. The scientific literature shows that the chronic stress of food insecurity, just that persistent low-level panic of not knowing how you will feed your dependents tomorrow, it creates a severe allostatic load on the body.
It's literally wearing down their biological systems.
Exactly. It elevates resting cortisol levels, it damages cardiovascular health, and it impairs cognitive function.
Right.
By allowing a parent to secure a meal quietly and anonymously, Neighbors Feeding Neighbors is doing far more than distributing calories. They are actively dismantling chronic biological stress and restoring basic dignity.
And the grant proposal also details how a barrier-free model can instantly adapt to acute community crises.
This was a really fascinating part of the proposal.
Yeah, and to be clear, you listening, we are highlighting this detail strictly as a factual example of how agile food networks operate to reach invisible populations. We are taking absolutely no political stance here.
Right, strictly just looking at the operational logistics.
Exactly. The source notes that NFN partnered with an organization called Immigration Aid during a period of local ICE enforcement. Local construction workers were too afraid to leave their homes to navigate the consumer food environment.
They were effectively trapped.
Right. So NFN immediately pivoted. They supplied 100 lunches per week to Immigration Aid volunteers, who then delivered them directly to the housebound workers, ultimately providing 800 meals.
It perfectly illustrates the limitations of heavy bureaucracy. When a program has zero red tape, aid can flow instantaneously to wherever a localized crisis spikes.
Well, so agile.
It is. But, you know, as vital as this agile grassroots volunteerism is, it relies heavily on individuals having the physical mobility to walk into a coffee shop, or at least having a network of volunteers who can find them.
Which isn't always the case.
No. We still desperately need structured, federally funded infrastructure to care for the populations that are permanently physically isolated.
Which brings us to populations that cannot leave their homes regardless of the circumstances. The JAMA qualitative study on the delivery trial focuses on Meals on Wheels, which operates under the Older Americans Act, or OAA.
Right, a massive federal program.
Yeah, this legislation is a structural pillar of elder care in the United States, and it's built on three statutory goals: reduce hunger and malnutrition, promote socialization, and promote overall health and well-being.
And the interviews conducted in this trial confirm that for the individuals receiving these meals, the program is life-altering. Participants report significant improvements in their dietary intake and their physical health.
It really keeps them going.
Crucially, the intervention provides the exact support necessary for these older adults to age in place, effectively keeping them out of institutionalized nursing homes.
But the structural gap highlighted in the government accountability data is devastating. Currently, 86% of older adults with low incomes and food insecurity do not receive home-delivered meals.
86%. That is a staggering failure of scale.
It is. Funding simply hasn't kept pace with inflation or the demographic reality of a rapidly aging population. So to study how to best deploy those limited resources, the DeliverE trial analyzed two delivery models. One group received meals delivered daily by a driver, while the other group received bulk frozen meals shipped in the mail every 2 weeks.
A very different approach.
Totally different. And I have to question the efficacy of that second model regarding the OAA's goal to, quote, promote socialization. The daily driver makes perfect sense. Participants detailed how drivers acted as a social lifeline. They'd chat with them and even run small errands like buying stamps.
Human connection.
Right. But the bulk shipped group simply received a cardboard box of frozen food on their porch. Does dropping a box of ice on a porch really fulfill the mandate to improve well-being and socialization the same way a daily driver does?
This raises an important question about how narrowly we define the beneficiaries of a public health intervention. You are absolutely correct that a cardboard box offers zero human connection.
It's just logistics at that point.
Yeah. And the researchers heavily emphasize the unique, irreplaceable value of the daily drivers checking in on vulnerable seniors. However, the study uncovered a massive systemic outcome that applied equally to both delivery methods. The intervention produced profound caregiver relief.
Oh, wow. I hadn't even considered the ripple effect on the family unit.
Right. The burden on the sandwich generation is immense. Imagine an adult daughter who works full-time, manages her own children, and bears the crushing logistical and financial stress of ensuring her physically isolated father has a hot meal every single night.
That is a massive amount of chronic stress for the caregiver.
Exactly. When Meals on Wheels intervenes even via biweekly frozen meal shipments, it completely removes that daily logistical panic. The trial documented drastic improvements in the finances, physical health, and emotional bandwidth of the recipient's unpaid family caregivers.
So the return on investment for the OAA goes far beyond just the nutritional value of the meal itself. By feeding the senior, the federal government is effectively stabilizing the mental and financial health of the entire working-age caregiving generation.
Precisely. We prevent the systemic collapse of family units. It demonstrates how intertwined our health outcomes truly are.
It really fundamentally reframes everything we've covered today. Whether you are a public health official drafting zoning laws, or a parent navigating the grocery aisle, or someone checking up on an aging relative, The sources prove that diet is an incredibly complex web.
It's never just the food.
Never. It is tied to the physical layout of your city, the biological impact of economic stress, and the fundamental human need for dignity.
It is the invisible scaffolding of our society. And to leave you with a final thought to mull over, I want to pull one brief, chilling warning from our very first source, the NIH report on food environments.
Okay. What did they warn about?
The researchers briefly mentioned the rapid rise of hybrid and online food shopping platforms, you know, systems entirely driven by machine learning and digital algorithms.
Right, the massive shift toward ordering groceries through apps and delivery services.
Yes. I want you to ponder this. As we slowly attempt to fix physical food deserts by subsidizing delivery and expanding online access, are we inadvertently building digital food deserts?
Wait, what do you mean?
Think about the mechanism of an algorithm. If it learns that a low-income shopper consistently buys cheap, highly processed foods to stretch a limited budget, the algorithm will naturally target them with aggressive ads and coupons for sugar-sweetened beverages to maximize engagement and profit.
Oh, wow. Because it knows they'll click on the cheap calories.
Exactly. We'll not show them the fresh spinach. Are we digitally redlining vulnerable populations? Are we trapping people in customized algorithmic environments that quietly push them into worse mental and physical health, far beyond the reach of any city zoning law?
That is a terrifying evolution. We are taking the geographic food desert and embedding it directly into the phones in our pockets.
The environment is constantly changing, and our critical awareness has to evolve just as quickly.
What a brilliant and unsettling concept to end on. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into the invisible forces shaping how we eat and how we live. Keep examining the scaffolding around you. Keep asking the hard questions. And remember, the next time you see an apple and a donut, you're not just looking at a choice. You're looking at a landscape. Until next time.